Hello, welcome back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 28. This episode, we're going to be talking about Castlevania Symphony of the Night for the PlayStation. Just the PlayStation. I'm Kevin Larrabee. The PS1. Remember that thing? I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me, first off, our special guest, Brian Davis from Next Level Games. Brian, how you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we've been going back and forth on Twitter about this stuff for a while. It's great to finally get you back on. And it was like almost 3 months ago when I said, all right, you know, I'd love to have you on the show, but I need to know, like, what's the game? What's the game that you're going to want to do? And, you know, without hesitation, you said Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Yeah, that's it's one of my favorite games. And well, I was surprised to hear that you hadn't played it before, so I'm very curious to kind of learn how you like your impressions of it now, because 14 years after it came out, right?
Yeah, so, it's like, you know, super old now. Not super old, but it is when we come to talking about video games, it is relatively old. The other voice that you hear on the line is, of course, Josh Hillier. Josh, what's up?
E3? What is E3 but a miserable pile of secrets?
That's one of the better ones.
Thank you.
That was a good one. We're actually recording this on the 1 year anniversary of the podcast. We did our very first episode, which was episode 0, The Legend of Zelda, on June 6th, 2013. And we're still going strong. Somehow we've knocked out 28 episodes plus another 6 Gaiden episodes. So a whole 34, or I guess 35, if you count episode 0, pieces of audio content for people out there. So before we get going any further, thank you out there to everyone who has downloaded the show, who has purchased t-shirts, who has gone on to iTunes to submit a review, who has connected with Josh and myself on Twitter. If you followed at Back in My Play, if you've told a friend about the show, thank you for everyone out there, because like I've mentioned on Twitter last week, you know, we wouldn't be doing this if people weren't listening. And of course, thank you to the guys over at 8-4, Mark McDonald, and John Riccardi, and even JJ for having me on 8-4 Play to talk about this podcast when it was only episode 7 or something like that. And again, thank you for everyone out there. And of course, the guys at Player One for coming on, Kurt Collada over at Hardcore Gaming 101, and to all the fantastic people like Mike Micah for spending so much time coming on the show. Steve Lin, there's, you know, tons of people, Patrick Klepek for coming on the show. It's just been kind of a crazy ride so far, and it has a legitimacy to it. So again, thank you to everyone out there, but I'm going to stop talking. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be playing lots of music from Castlevania Symphony of the Night. So stick around. We'll be right back with the history. Let's talk about the history of the game. First off, the release date. It came out in Japan on March 20th, 1997, and October 2nd, a little bit while later, in North America that same year. It was developed by Konami Computer Entertainment Tokyo, and of course, it was published by Konami. Just some interesting pieces of the development history. Although the game was directed by Toru Hagihara, assistant director Koji Igarashi, is said to have the most creative influence over the game, as he was also involved in the story writing and programming. From the beginning, the game was to represent a fresh new direction for the franchise. According to Igarashi, Symphony of the Night started out as, quote, something of a side story for the series. We were able to break a lot of the Castlevania conventions and introduce a lot of new elements that we still use today. This primary motivation for the abrupt design change was seeing dozens of Castlevania games in the used bargain bin in Japanese video game stores, as linear Castlevania games offered limited replay value after completion. And I will say anecdotally that I went out there. Those games are expensive now. Those are hard to find in bargain bins. So I guess ever since that time period, these games are just up on the shelves and are pretty expensive. The team used inspiration from Zelda as well as Super Metroid to make most of the castle areas initially inaccessible to the player. The player would gradually obtain various items and vampiric, like vampire-like powers that opened up more and more of the castle. The idea was to reward exploration while retaining the hack and slash action from the previous game. So, one of the big things with this game is the soundtrack. And before we go any further, I'm going to let you know that it is still available from the Japanese Amazon website. So if you have a connection, if you have a friend in Japan, the soundtrack's only like $20. Or if you buy it from pretty much anywhere I could look in America, you're looking at $50. So thank you to Robert Pelka for sending that out there.
And it's the Symphony of the Night soundtrack. It's not like just generic like Castlevania with songs from all the games.
Correct.
Wow.
And it is titled Dracula X Nocturne in the Moonlight, which is weird because I was just a side note. When I was we did Rondo of Blood, I was looking for that CD soundtrack on Amazon in Japan. And this is like, I kept typing in Dracula X and stuff like that, and I could not find the soundtrack for Rondo of Blood. This was the soundtrack that it was actually always popping up. And I didn't think I really liked this soundtrack until I played this game, because I never got far enough into the game to hear the good stuff. So anyways, the music in the game was composed by Michiru Yamane, who had previously composed a soundtrack for Castlevania Bloodlines on the Sega Genesis. The soundtrack contains elements from multiple music genres, notably classical, but also techno, gothic, rock, new age music, jazz, and many variations of metal. In particular, the most extreme genres such as thrash metal and black metal. I don't have any black metal CDs, I don't think. I Am the Wind, a vocal ending theme written by Rika Murunaka and Tony Haynes, performed by Cynthia Harrell, is played during the credits. So the soundtrack does contain a few tracks that are remixes from pieces from Rondo of Blood, particularly Dance of Illusions, which is one of my favorite tracks in the game. The music that plays during Rondo of Blood's last boss. There's also Blood Relations, a variation of the piece heard in the first stage of Rondo of Blood, Bloodlines. The original PlayStation version of the game included an audio track featuring an arranged version of the tune Dracula's Castle called Alucard's Vengeance, which can be played on an actual audio CD player after listening to Alucard's warning. So if you have the original disc, you can actually pop it into a CD player. You'll hear a warning from Alucard saying, you know, don't play this CD. And then you can hear
that's awesome.
Song.
That is seriously awesome.
It's that Red Book audio awesomeness. Did either of you guys, before we go further, I know I'm jumping the gun, but did either of you do this? Did you put your copy into your boombox or whatever and try it out, Josh?
Oh yes, absolutely. We would always do that back in the day.
Going out, you know, hanging out with the boys, get in the car and put in some Symphony of the Night.
Yeah, and just we had to fight ladies off with a stick.
Right. I bet.
No, seriously, it would be like, you know, just put it in there and see if anything plays, you know? I mean, that was what we did with anything that was like worth playing at least. And, you know, with a game with a soundtrack that good, we were all over that.
How about you, Brian?
Yeah, it was just like, when Ridge Racer came out, it had the audiobooks CD on it, right? So you could just throw that in the CD player.
Yeah.
So yeah, we actually like, I can't remember, we might have even put the soundtrack in Ridge Racer. Like we might have put Symphony of the Night in Ridge Racer to get that audio track to play.
That's a great thing, is that with the CD technology, you had the Redbook audio option where you could just dump the tracks on the back of the CD so people could just take the CD out of the case. You know, of course, when I'm not playing this video game, I just want to constantly listen to the soundtrack, so I can put that into a boombox. I'm trying to think, the only time I ever might have tried that was N2O on the PlayStation 1, which is a weird like racing game. I can't even remember. It had a really sick soundtrack though, like a techno soundtrack. If you think hackers, that's kind of like what it's like. So
I like that you're calling it a boombox, by the way, Kevin. Very 90s.
Yeah, I'm trying
to stick with what we had back then. Yeah.
Sticking with the theme. So it was not initially a hit. It was released to rave reviews, but not a lot of people bought it because Konami didn't really advertise it very much. But it was a slow burner, and eventually it did get released, re-released as a greatest hits title in the United States. And just a couple fun facts, some other notable releases. Of course, it came out in the Sega Saturn, which is the, I would probably say the worst version of the game. Even though the Sega Saturn was known to do 2D much better, but transparencies not so much. So there was a lot of issues with things like water and things like that. So it didn't do very well on the Sega Saturn, but I guess Sega put out the money to get it on there. At least there was enough demand to get it out in Japan. And also, this is when I initially really played it, was a port on the Xbox 360 in 2006. I still remember, like, this was right about the time that Crackdown came out, because I have vivid memories of, like, man, this is the game. Like, they're raising the limits on how big Xbox Live Arcade games can be. And you can't even fit this thing on a memory card, so you have to have the hard drive to pull this out. And that's when they put out the 512 megabyte cards for the 360. But that was great. And then also it is unlockable on the Castlevania Dracula X Chronicles, like we've talked about in the episode for Rondo of Blood with Kurt Collada. And the final fun fact for ports was a version was being worked on for the console that I owned. My grandparents got this for me, and I owned two whole games for it the whole time I had it. One, which was Lights Out, I think. And this was the Gamecom.
What a console, too.
I played the crap out of that Gamecom because I had Williams Arcade Hits or something like that on it. And that was my first introduction to almost all those games. So I ended up playing that quite a bit.
Okay. Well, I had one too, but I don't have the same kind of memories you have, apparently.
I just have...
But I always felt bad about life when I was playing it.
Oh, I'm a weird person. I'll admit it. Like I said, I'm a portable, crazy person these days. But I think...
Well, the Vita's awesome. I mean, you have a point with that.
And I mean the Neo Geo Pocket Color. All right, so let's take a quick break, and we're going to be right back with our memories and our personal history with this beautiful Castlevania game. So stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. We're here to talk about our personal memories and history with this wonderful Castlevania classic. And since you are a guest, Brian, I'm going to toss it off to you. When was the first time that you started like seeing this game? Was it in magazines, and were you anticipating the game? And also, you know, what were your first thoughts when you were playing it? Did you, you know this was going to be one of the greatest games that you've ever played?
Right. So I think the game came out fall 97, and I had never heard of the game outside of one of my friends. My friend Enrico DeFranco, he's a hardcore gamer. So me and him talked about games all the time, and he showed me the game in Game Fan magazine. And so he ended up buying the game, and he showed it to me, and we played the heck out of the game. And like, he was really into like importing stuff, and he had a Sega Saturn. Like, no one else in our neighborhood had one. Mm-hmm. So he was like the guy for hardcore stuff. So he was kind of the ambassador that brought me to the game, and me and him just played it like crazy. It was
did fun. You play it on Saturn?
No, we played it on PS1. I think he might have got it at launch. I can't remember. It was either between fall 97 or summer 98 back then.
Okay. It's kind of crazy that when I brought this up on Twitter that we're going to be doing this, multiple people pointed out to me that they imported the game and played it like a bunch before they even played the US version. Then they got the US version and then they played that a bunch. But I might have been that guy, but I'm worried if I had someone that was like that into games when I was a kid, that I would have just been so locked into that path. Every penny, I mean, even more so, would have gone into games, and then getting into importing and stuff like that was a dangerous road to go down outside of just looking at the back of magazines for those like import ads and things like that. So when you got it, was this like a straight up, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to play this until I fall asleep, and then I'm going to wake up as soon as possible and I'm going to start playing it again?
Pretty much. Like, we were initially, it was the graphics that kind of drew us in, right? Like, the sprites were amazing at the time, and they still, you know, hold up pretty well. Cause like at the time, everybody was going 3D.
Exactly.
Because it was like kind of like the first venture into 3D graphics on consoles, you know, games started looking muddy. So when this game came out, it just kind of popped. So we're really drawn into that. But I think it was the voice acting initially that Enrico and I kind of like connected with, because we really liked Resident Evil 1, and we both liked horror games, right? Like, the voice acting in both those games were so over the top. I think even to this day, I still prefer the original voices over the kind of the ones they redid for the Dracula X Chronicles for PSP, just because I kind of like that cheesiness. Like, it's kind of like a B horror movie type thing, right?
Well, yeah, it was like the case where in a lot of instances, these companies would just get, like the Japanese companies would just, oh, we have a guy that speaks English working at our Japanese office. Yeah, you know, he can be Alucard. just come down to the recording studio and do it. Although I think they actually got, you know, real voice actors to do this, but it was still, like you're saying, it was before the time where there was lots of direction for this stuff. They basically just got a guy in a booth and they recorded lines, and then they just dropped it into the game.
The other thing that we were drawn to was, it was kind of like, it was a game where it was an action game, and it was an adventure game, and it was an RPG. So it kind of had the best elements from all those genres packed into one game. And like, it had stuff so you could, if you were the collector type, you could go through the entire map trying to find all the life and the heart max ups. You could try and get every little percent on the map. So I think it had something for different types of gamers.
Were you coming off of Super Metroid? Was that
That's
at
a great
the top
question.
Of your, you know, Super Nintendo top 10 list?
At the time, I think I had played Super Metroid 3. It was like 3 years before this, right? So I was more into A Link to the Past than Super Metroid, which I learned later on when I went to GDC and I was talking to Igarashi-san he basically said that A Link to the Past was their favorite game. And that's what inspired this game, because they wanted to make, you know, a Link to the, like, a new Zelda game. Because a lot of time people say that, you know, it's the original inspiration was Super Metroid, but in actuality, it was A Link to the Past.
I can see that, though, especially with, we're going to get into some spoilers, right? It's sort of inevitable.
Yeah, if you haven't played the game, pause the episode and you can download this. I should mention that you can get this on, you know, multiple different services. So if you want to get it on like Xbox Live or PSN, you can play it on like anything, or you can just go find the disc. The disc is actually not that expensive anymore. So
yeah, go play it and then listen to the episode. You really owe it to yourself to play it before you listen to the episode anyway.
It's hard to spoil this game. Like, you know, it's an experience. It's less like, oh man, you totally, you know, fight that thing.
Well, my point though was going to be about the second castle, you know, like the inverted castle, you know, and then like Link to the Past has like normal Hyrule and then the dark version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So you can see that similarity. And that's really interesting that they see that as more of an influence to them than Super Metroid, even though those games are both on a 2D side scrolling plane. Instead of top-down 3D, I mean 2D in the case of Link to the Past.
I wish, and this is for the Zelda 2 people out there, like if Zelda 2 was like this, like,
yeah,
like this game, like I think that would be totally rad. Or even something like more like Simon's Quest. Just because I still cannot get into, like, every 3 months trying to play Zelda 2. Just does not click every single time I try to play it. I just rather listen to the soundtrack. But no, it's a really great point to bring up. Like that is a crazy connection, because like you said, everyone thinks it is Super Metroid. Like that's the game, and now it is Metroidvania is the word that's brought up when games like this come out, whether it's Guacamelee or whether it's like SteamWorld Dig, all that stuff.
Yeah, I think it's because people mostly look at the structural, like the structure of the progression of the game.
Like the map and stuff, right?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think that's the most visual part. If you haven't seen it yet, I would definitely check out Igarashi-san's GDC talk. It's free on the GDC vault, because he goes into a lot of detail about why they changed things in the game and the reason they went down certain paths. Like the reason why they chose a 2D game was because they had so many great level designers that only worked in 2D. So they wanted to make sure that they were, you know, their talents were shown. So that was the main reason why they kind of chose that route.
So it's like, you know, it's common sense. Like they use common sense instead of trying to just look at the market or what the, you know, whatever the marketing people are saying is that people want 3D. They want, you know, another 3D action game with giant enemy crabs and stuff. So the, Josh, how about you? I mean, I will just jump and say that I didn't really play this much. I actually wasn't on my radar. Didn't even know this game existed until like in 2002 or 3 or 4 when people would start talking about this game in retrospect. So you guys are the lucky ones. So I want to hear your stories.
Well, you know, kind of what you're talking about, it was one of the last games to sort of get a cult following before the internet became a big deal. I mean, I know the internet was around when this game released, but before it became a more commonplace for people to have discussions about games, you know? So I think it actually makes sense that you would have missed it. It just looks like another Castlevania game if you just look at the box. So I only knew about it from magazine coverage and stuff like what Brian was talking about. And I had a really good friend, still do, Graham Locke, who got the game, and so we played it together a ton, and I rented it a couple of times. And, you know, that was the beauty of having, unlike cartridges, right, you could save onto the PlayStation 1's memory card and actually rent something and then rent it again and keep playing the game regardlessly of whether you got the original copy you had the first time. So that was pretty nice that I was able to basically play through the game by renting it and taking my memory card to my friend's house.
Tell me you played Metal Gear after this.
I actually didn't. I'm sorry.
Oh, you didn't get to have I see you play Castlevania.
That is so cool. I love stuff like that. I really do.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. But no, I somehow or another managed to not do that. And that's a long story. But anyway, loved it to death. I loved Super Metroid, though. Like, you know, you asked Brian that question a minute ago, if that was one of his favorite games coming into this one. And it was for me. And I had heard the game be compared, or I guess I should say I had read about the game being compared to Super Metroid in some ways. And that was one of the reasons I was really excited. And I just loved what they were doing with the formula of Castlevania, because I was already a fan of the series at that point. Mm. So, you know, to see them going in this sounds like marketing speak, but this bold new direction, you know, making it have RPG elements and so many unlockables. It was just addictive to play, you know? Like, I mean, I remember like a night where we played it all night long because you could always find something new.
You could always just keep. I mean, that's one thing I'd like to talk about later, but you know, there's very few times where you are like, I have no idea where to go, because you can just pop open that map and you're like, oh man, there's a square that's not closed off.
Exactly. And even being lost isn't that bad, you know?
Like, you're jamming out, man. You're popping up those tunes. You got your stereo speakers.
That's right. And you're leveling up your character as you run around and, you know, fight some enemies that you end up being way more powerful than over time in the first castle, at least. Mm. And it was just a wonderful game then. And I remember thinking this, and I've talked about this a lot on different episodes of this show, that, man, I really wish that all of these 32-bit era games were sprite based, or more of them were, at least, because I always thought that polygonal 3D looked ugly on the 32-bit machines. I know that sounds like, you know, nerdy hardcore gamer talk, but I mean, seriously, I just, you know, always thought that stuff was ugly. I didn't think it started to look good until like the Dreamcast era. And
you gotta break some eggs, man, to make a cake or something.
I know. Yeah. Well, this cake was really not very tasty at all.
Well, but do you mind if go ahead.
Yeah. But anyway, this stood out because it was it was honestly a bit of a throwback only 2 years after we were removed from the 16-bit generation to that graphic style. And I really appreciated it. So what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, unlike you losers, I had a Nintendo 64. So my graphics were fantastic. And
that polygonal 3D is not bad, like when you look at Mario 64 and stuff like that.
But that's the thing, is I was actively subscribing to GamePro at the time, so I knew what was on the PlayStation. That's why I waited so long to get one, because when I compared 3D games, which I was ready for 3D. When I got my Nintendo 64, like, I had Wayne Gretzky's 3D hockey. Mm-hmm. I didn't have Wayne Gretzky's hockey. And I had, you know,
sprite-based hockey.
Yeah, I had Super Mario 64, and I had polygonal graphics, polygons, which is what I was dropping my $200 on, or my mom was dropping her $200 on. So when I looked at a lot of that stuff that the PlayStation was doing early on, like you said, like Twisted Metal kind of looked rough. Like when I saw that in a demo unit, I was like, this doesn't really look that great. And then I would see like 2D games. Like, why would I get a system to play 2D games on when I already had a Super Nintendo and I had a Sega Genesis before that? I want 3D games. I want new experiences. I want Duke Nukem 3D or Duke Nukem 64. So, I think for you guys, you lucked out, because you saw that when I didn't see it. I was just kind of the latest. I wanted the latest, the greatest stuff out there, where you guys could recognize that, no, this is just really, this looks great, even though, you know, it's 2D and it's not going to be, you know, necessarily selling people just via a commercial. That might be why Konami didn't advertise it very hard, because
I could see that.
What's it going to look like next to, like, even Castlevania 64?
Right. And all the other PS1 games that were, you know, because the PS1 was really hitting its stride at that point in terms of consistent releases of big name titles.
For sure.
Yeah, I think Resident Evil was my first PS1 game. And at the time, I thought it looked unbelievable. Like, you know, now when I look back 15 years later, you can definitely see it. But when you're a kid that age and it's your first time seeing 3D graphics, like, I thought it looked, you know, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But I got PS1, and then a year later I got N64.
That's how I did it too.
Yeah.
That's probably the better way to do it, because at that time, you know, you had the PS1 had a year ahead of it of the N64. So it had an extra year of games and things like that. So you guys did it right. But I needed Super Mario 64 and I needed Shadows of the Empire. Like those were the two things that at the time were most important to me. But Resident Evil 2, you know, specifically when I saw that, when I saw FMV games, when I saw the demo for Final Fantasy VII, not because I wanted to play it, but because of that intro, you know, FMV or the CG cutscene or whatever, I'm like, this destroys anything my N64 can do. But lo and behold, I own Resident Evil 2 on the N64 and it looks dope. And the FMV looks pretty good too.
I forgot there was FMV in that version of the game.
Oh, it's the biggest N64 game. It's for the storage on the cart.
Yeah, it's physically it's a physically heavy game too. If you hold it in your hands,
It's just packed. It's 512. Maybe it's not 512 megabits or whatever. I don't know. Anyways, we're here to talk about Castlevania Symphony of the Night. So that is our history.
Oh, wait, let me tell this one story. This is really stupid. Yeah. So this friend of mine I was telling you about, Graham Locke, he came over to my house and he brought his save file. And through some weird set of events, you know, okay, so you could have the PS1 with the disc tray open and, you know, powered on and move around files on your memory card and do all that. So we were doing that and somehow or another, I accidentally clicked to delete his entire memory card. And, that was, I know. And there was this moment when I distinctly remember it. I was holding the power button on the PS1 and he was like, don't let go. Don't let go. It's going to let me restore it. And then like my finger slipped.
Dude.
And I know. And he lost. And that was the file that he was really upset about, was his Symphony of the Night file, because he had everything unlocked, like 100% of the map and everything else. And I'm very sorry, Graham, to this day.
On that note, after you guys beat the game, did you play as Richter?
I was sort of done with it, but he did.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's just like, you know, keep this train rolling. How about you?
I was never very good at the previous Castlevania games, which is kind of why I liked Symphony of the Night so much, because I actually I could play it really well. So when I played it as Richter, I haven't beaten the game yet.
That does take away a lot of the intricacies of the combat that you're given with Alucard. You know, when you have to start relying on Richter's moveset.
Yeah, it becomes more of an action game than a kind of adventure game, I guess.
Exactly, which the game just is not built to be.
Yeah.
Well, you know, could be worse. You could have gotten like, you know, me when I got those. Don't ever, if you ever go back in time to play these old consoles, or you buy them old, buy used consoles, try to only use first party memory cards, because this was the time where if you got a third party, like no name brand memory card or rubble pack, that it was absolute garbage. So spend the extra 50 cents in, you know, if you buy a used PS1 memory card and get the Sony branded one, or same thing with N64, get the Nintendo branded one. But other than that, here's some more fantastic music from the game. Go buy that CD and stick around. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. right, we're back to revisit, or in my case, discover the illustrious Castlevania Symphony of the Night for the PlayStation Entertainment System. That's not what they called it. Anyways, the so I'm going to do something that's outside of the norm. I'm going to start off this segment because the game itself is something that I have tried to play a couple times in the last 10 years or so, even getting a retail copy of it through a Craigslist huge video game bulk lot when I went to this random house from a landlord. It's like, yeah, I have a bunch of video games this guy left behind, and I got a gold mine of video games. Like, I remember getting like probably $1,500 worth of games for like $200. It was the craziest thing at the time. But I did also try replaying it when it came out on Xbox Live. I downloaded it and purchased it that day, but it couldn't grab me for some reason. Same thing when I started playing it for this this show. I would always get stuck at this part that was right at the save point, that if you went outside the save point, you would start getting attacked by a table and the plants that were on the table, like the vase that was on the table and stuff like that. And then you would have to go up and then right. If you played the game, you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's like, there's a good length of time before you get to the next save point. And I could just never get to that save point. I would just like, again, if you're playing it on an Xbox or you're playing it on a PSP or something like that, you can just like, oh, well, I have a bunch of games on this console. I'm just going to flip this off. Like, I don't need to play it right now. I'll come back to it later because it's just bugging me. I can't master the controls enough. But
I think that stretch, just to jump in for a second, I think that stretch of the game is one of the only parts of the game that is not that well balanced.
No, it's the only one. It's the only part that I really had trouble.
Yeah, because I experienced that. Like, I remember distinctly the first time that I played the game, I know exactly what you're talking about. I can like picture that whole area. And like, we tried going down instead of to the right and still kept messing up because you're not that powerful yet, you know? So like, all the enemies are just wailing on you.
Yeah. And I'm like, no, this game's garbage. People don't know what they're talking about. Right. I'm just going to go play Crackdown. So the experience of this podcast and allowing me to play through Castlevania 1, beating Rondo of Blood, I think has given me the tools. I have the practice. I have the skills to play a Castlevania game now and have just some ability to get a little bit further than I had before. And of course, this is one of the reasons why I started the podcast at all, is to just make myself be like, dude, you have to play the game. You have responsibility to do this. So you're going to have to play it. And once I got past that breaking point, I remember specifically, like, it was a couple minutes later, I started like sending messages to Brian, being like, dude, this game, oh my God. And it kept happening like over and over again. Like every other day I get to play a little bit more. And I'd be like, man, I can't believe like how great this thing is. So I won't mention, I played it on the PlayStation Vita, which is the PlayStation 1 version. It runs pretty good, and it runs for $10 on the PlayStation Network and about $10 wherever you are. So it's one of the more expensive PlayStation 1 titles, which I guess they can charge extra for it because people really want to play that game, even though it's really not a big game in terms of memory. Also, the button customization is something that is important because since you do not have dual triggers, you do need to remap a couple of the buttons to either the actually did it to the front screen, which worked out great because that was easy to just tap on to go into the different modes, whether it was like the wolf or into the mist. Also, I need to mention, this is like the longest game we've played on the show besides Shenmue.
Like, yeah, it really is. It really is. I was thinking about that. But, you know, we took extra time to play it.
Yeah, it almost 3 months to play it. Just said, but for me, it was really the last 2 weeks. And the thing that really jumps out at you is, of course, the animation, like you guys were talking about before, where the game just moves beautifully. Like, there isn't any slowdown. And even when there's like parts where I'll be running through a stage just to like blow through it, and then I'll get stuck in a part, and then there'll be nine enemies on top of me, no slowdown. Like, it's still going rock solid. Mm-hmm. So it can keep up with all the craziness that could possibly happen before moving on to the next screen. Cool things like just the running, when you're running towards one side and then you change directions to the other side, just that little like almost slide, like that mm-hmm. momentum slide, that feel that you get that you don't really get from, like, it's a bad example, but like a Mega Man, you don't get that feel of changing of momentum from another game, that need to slow down, like things like that, that bug me in NBA 2K or whatever, when they started doing that, you couldn't just like do a beeline to a different direction. And of course the soundtrack, like it's the soundtrack for the first hour and a half is kind of like wasn't doing anything for me. But after that, it was like area after area after area where I was dropping tracks like Crystal Teardrop, which is, if you play the game, it's the track that almost sounds like it's downsampled, like it's a lower bit rate for the drums. And it's, mm-hmm. It's such a weird friggin' sound. Like it's hard to even explain it. There's an ice area where it's like a frozen area where it just, everything sounds so different from area to area to area. And you can still get those tracks that will get you to like start nodding your head. And I played this game, like I said, on the Vita exclusively with nice headphones on. And I had that thing turned up all the way the whole time. The big issue though, is that you cannot adjust the music and the sound effects. So the sound effects are a little bit too loud. That's kind of a pain in the butt. I'm letting you jump in so I can take a breath.
Yeah, man, that's fine. What were you talking about a minute ago with remapping the buttons on, you did that playing it on the Vita?
Yeah, I mean, if the one of the good things with the Vita is that you can hold down the PlayStation button on it and you can completely remap all the controls as much as you want, like even the directionals if you wanted to. You can map them wherever, because
into the stick or whatever.
Correct. Like, because you need R1, L1, R2, L2 to go through all the transformations for the mist and for the and for the wolf and stuff like that. So I needed to remap that, because there was a time I was like, I know I have this ability. How do I select it? Like I couldn't figure out how to, turn into something. And then randomly I would turn into, like the wolf, and I'm like, oh, I'm hitting the rear touch thing by mistake. So I remapped it to the front, which is a little bit less likely to, get hit on. But like, that's another thing, the depth in this game with things that you can turn into and the abilities that you have was almost too much for me. Like, I didn't use the summons once in the whole game.
Yeah, you know, they're not really even that necessary. That's
or the special point. Moves, or like the finishers, or like they look like Mortal Kombat fatalities.
Cool, extremely cool.
There's like one of the things I recently discovered that I had never used before in the game is there's a gravity boots move where you can basically jump straight up and hit the ceiling with your head.
What?
If you press down and then press up on the D-pad right away, he'll do like a super jump straight up with like a laser beam line below him. Like, I just discovered this last week, like 14 years after the game came out.
Yeah, there's a move like that in Super Metroid, where if you're sprinting and then you can hold up to do that, you know, rocket jump or whatever.
Oh yeah. Is that what you're talking about, Brian? I mean, is it that extent? Like, you kind of like fly up through the air like that?
Yeah, it's almost exactly like that, but you do it stationary. You don't have to run or anything, and you can combine it. You only go to a certain height, so you can like keep doing it. There's the the guy in the library that sells you stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He if you go underneath him and use that move, you can knock him up.
And
he gives you Life Max collectible.
What?
Yeah.
That is awesome. Like, seriously.
Like, I didn't even know this till last week, which is pretty cool.
I always saw, like, you see that he's sitting in a four-legged chair, that right below him is, like a a tunnel to below him to the screen below. You're like, why is he sitting like that? Like, there has to be something with that. And I tried constantly jumping over him and stuff like that. But every time you get close to him, it goes into the dialogue, like, you know, what can I get you or something like that? You know, kind of like the Resident Evil 4 dude.
Cause I was going to ask you, Kevin, as well, like, what was it like for you to kind of experience like one of the biggest, like most iconic moments in gaming, which was the, you know, beating the game and then going back and learning that, hey, I've only beaten half the game.
It was okay. Well, I was talking to you about this on Twitter through like direct messages, because as soon as I got that bat ability, the ability to fly, I recognized those stairs from Rondo of Blood. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go up the stairs and I'm going to get this thing done so I can go play some other stuff. because I was like, you know, I like to beat games and move on to the next one. So I have like a 56% percent completion when I'm looking at my save file, and I'm like, oh, whatever, I'm going to go beat them. And I beat them and it's super easy. And then you're like, actually, like, do you have the gold ring? Do you have the silver ring? Like, no. Like, I don't have that. Do you have the holy glasses or whatever? No, I don't have that. It's like, go keep looking. So that's what I did. After I had that bad ability, I obviously, there was a lot of places I could open up by flying, and like literally that bat flying ability, that thing lasts forever. Like, they don't, you know, restrict you when it comes to using that thing. So, you can just fly all over the place, fill in all the blocks, and then find stuff that you missed out on. And that's when, I mean, that first off, that's when I found out there was a whole nother half of the game that I missed, because there were, I'm dead serious. Like, there was I think I missed five areas by not, you know, searching, not looking around. So I was able to, you know, find all these places, like find the guy in the boat, like the, you know, find all these areas and find all these special bosses, and, eventually get to like the real final boss battle. And, you know, obviously seeing that green orb and destroying that, and going on to the second, like, I remember after it happened, I remember hearing people talk about that upside down castle and stuff like that. But even then, I'm like, man, I've been playing for 8 hours. Like, this is a 16 hour game. Mm-hmm. Like, this is no joke.
Cause I'm very curious, like, how people discovered that you had to use the holy glasses. Like,
well, how did you discover it? Because I would have, If I was just, I got the credits rolled, the castle was done. I'm like, I literally put a thing up on Twitter. This game was pretty good. I'm done. And then you're like, no, actually you haven't even seen the final boss. And then I even got all that stuff. And I went and I fought him again, and I didn't, hit the green orb. You fight Richter, which first off, I was like, holy crap, dude, what is going on here? I'm fighting Richter. Like, this is my boy. This is the guy that I defeated Dracula with. Like, what's going on here? So, you know, I fought him. He was a little bit harder, even though I could see the green orb. And like, I got a different ending where, I forgot the girl's name, but she's like, oh, you weren't able to save Richter. I'm like, nah, dude, I had to ice him. Like, I had to cut him, because he was throwing crosses at me and stuff. So eventually I did the third time going through that battle. And that's when the other castle came up. And that was the time when I'm like, all right, this might be one of the top 15 games that I've ever played in my life. And I'm doing a really bad job explaining it, because there's so much stuff to talk about in this game. And I feel like, I almost feel bad for just dumping this on you guys, but even like the weird one-off enemies that would just show up in a random room. Like, there's a guy just sitting in, like, it almost looks like a hot spring guarding green tea. And it's just some random dude. And that's like the one time that you see him. And there's like one-off items. Like, there's so much little detail in this game.
And like, what about the room that you like walk through a wall to get to? It's in the first castle. And there's like a confessional. You know what I'm talking about? Where you like sit down. Yeah, I mean, you might have missed that. Brian, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like there's different outcomes depending on what character walks in the room afterwards.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so like this time playing it, I sat down on the, like the priest side, and then, you know, like the, a ghost of a woman, I can't remember exactly who it is, came in and sat down and was like crying in the other chair. It's just,
what?
And you can totally miss that.
I did totally miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it depends, like, depending on what colored shirt that character is wearing, the outcome is different as well. Like there's so much detail going on there.
So like, what are some of the outcomes? Do you remember?
I think one time there's like a negative outcome where they stab you through that thing.
I think I remember that from a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure how to trigger the different ones, but I was reading about it and I'm like, I had no idea this was even in the game. Uh-huh. Like, I think that's why the game has such a following, because you're always finding new things mm-hmm. in the game, right?
There's so much. There's so much in this game, and the like, you just look at the map, it is gigantic. The best way I can put this is that I love this game, and mm-hmm. there's very few things that I felt like I could write down to just single out. Like, you play an 8-bit game, you can pick like four things that make this game great. With this game, it's almost like every part of this game is fantastic. Like I said, the details that are just like little details in the backgrounds, or just like the one-time use enemies. There's just, obviously, there's a huge amount of enemies. There's a huge amount of weapons. There's a huge amount of secret places where you can find, you know, the ability to carry more hearts or get more life. There are, there's that whole option, which I don't even know if this is a good thing. Like, there's the possibility that you might miss 50% of the first castle and never even see the second castle if you just get that bat ability and go and finish the boss battle. You might just like rent the game and say, yeah, I'm done. I don't even know if that's a good thing though. I think that might be bad, because then you go trade it in or something. And then you have your friends say, oh, so what'd you think of the upside down castle? Like, how did you,
like, have, are we even talking about the same game at this point?
Exactly.
Well, that was just a different time in terms of game development, though, when, you know, it was okay for people not to see everything in your game. I mean, it wasn't as directed of an experience.
Brian, how do you think it holds up?
Well, even when I play it today, the graphics are still really good. Like, the animation, like, the frame rate is really good. Like, there are slowdown points, but they actually time the slowdown points to make them look like they're slowing down the game. Like, when you beat a boss and like the icon comes out, the collectible, the game slows down so much because there's so much particles in the screen, but it looks like it's supposed to be epic. So it's almost like they took advantage of slowdown to make the game look good.
I would fully believe that too, based on, you know, all the details in this game, that they would pay attention to when the game's slowing down. That's a really interesting observation.
Yeah. Like, I think you can definitely see the passion of the developers in the game, because they went into it wanting to fix the things that they had, you know, the frustrating things that they found in the previous games. They wanted to fix that in this game. And so it was kind of like a passion project for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And was this Iga's first Castlevania? Was this his first time like with a prominent role on the development team? Do you know?
I believe so. Like, he was the programmer and he was a director of sorts, and it was his first Castlevania game as well.
Oh, it was his first one. Okay, I wasn't sure if he had worked on previous ones before that. And so then we saw, you know, there was a long time before. Well, I mean, I guess you have the GBA games that are somewhat in this formula, and then there was how many DS games? I think like three or four.
Three DS games, two GBA games.
Okay, mm-hmm. and he was directing all of those, right? Or at least high up in the development of all of them, making decisions. Certainly,
supposedly he was at E3 promoting that stuff. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I mean, he'd wear the hat and have the whip and all that, but. Just sort of future casting a little bit. It's just a shame, you know, that we're not getting more of these kinds of Castlevania games, and we're getting the ones that are being made right now instead.
Lights of Shadows is really good.
I mean, it is what it is, and I appreciate it. Like, I'm not trying to say it's an inherently bad game.
This is the first game that Josh doesn't like, the new Castlevania games.
Ever. Have I talked about that on the podcast before?
That you don't like the Lords of Shadow games?
Mercury Steam ones, or Stream, whatever. I don't like them. I guess I should just come out and say it. But I mean, those are nice people, you know? So that's what I'm always thinking about when I'm negative about something. But it just feels too God of War-y or whatever. And, you know, I guess it's just that I still think of Castlevania and I think about Symphony of the Night. So it's probably my fault. It's just that I can't get over the 90s.
I guess not.
I kind of have like a counterpoint to that, which is, you know, we have this game, and they made so many different, you know, other versions of it, but this, like, they're probably never going to remake Symphony of the Night, because they can just release it now, and it's still a great game. They don't even have to remake it.
True.
Because right now, like, they released it, and I bought the game, like, 3 times, I think, in various ways. So it's kind of like, I don't know if I would want another game in this exact way, just because I like it the way it is. I almost want like a new twist on this sort of format.
Yeah, I think there's something still to be done with the Castlevania franchise. Like, there's something that they haven't quite gotten to yet. Maybe something between what we're seeing with Lords of Shadow and like this style of Metroidvania, if you want to use that term, Castlevania game. There's something that just hasn't happened yet. And I don't know how interested Konami is in actually finding it, though.
Yeah. Well, Igarashi-san's in indie now, so he can make whatever he wants, I guess. So
I'm sure he's thinking about doing something. I mean, that was the rumor that you know, he might do like a Kickstarter or something like that for a new game like this. But for your the Mike Micah mention of the show, I believe that his company worked on the Xbox Live Arcade port of the game. It was Digital Eclipse that did the port and Backbone Entertainment. So again, it goes for the theory that that dude worked on friggin' every game in the last 20 years that's come that came out.
Yeah, at some point he's touched the code of every game.
No, it's right. This is it's the same company that created or worked on Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection, Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo. Man, Mike, every game, works on every single game. So with some closing stuff, like, I just want to say that don't be like me. Don't be like one of those guys that just kind of like puts this game off, because it should be played. And I think it's way better than Super Metroid. I think it's a much better game. I think it is.
It's easier to get into. Why that?
I wouldn't say that, but I think it's a meatier experience. Like, it's got some more meat, and it also just has a great feel to it. And if you've played earlier Castlevania games, there's so many callbacks to the earlier games that will just, you know, hit those right notes for you. And there's so many, like, there's so many moments in the game, whether it's like finding one of those life extenders and just being like, oh my God, like, yeah, I found this, I needed this so bad, or finding that weapon that was 3 hit points better, or you know, walking into a room and being like, oh crap, that boss is gigantic, I am screwed, I need to pause real quick, go through my inventory, make sure I got some potions, and make sure I have like some special items, like if he's gonna throw lightning at me, if I gotta make sure I get that lightning resist, or if I have like a shield amplifier, I gotta make sure I got that going for me. Like, there were just constantly so many moments, and even just seeing bosses that have come back from earlier games was really, really cool. I think this is the hardest game that we've ever had to talk about on the show, because I just feel so scattered when I talk about it, because there are so many things. It's like walking into a store where there's all this great stuff that you want to look at, and it's like, oh man, look at this. Oh, look at this. Look at this. Look at this. Like, I just don't know what to really focus on with this stuff, just because from top to bottom, it is just, it earns the right of being a classic. It is a classic, and it probably should be in the top, you know, 25, top 50 games of all time. It's that good.
Yeah, completely agree. And even like we haven't talked a whole lot about the beginning, have we? The very beginning of the game.
No. Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, even that, you know, that's like almost
it's the Back to the Future too. It is
exactly.
It goes right from Rondo of Blood right into Dracula. Symphony of the Night.
Yeah, I mean, so you're playing the same character and all that stuff, and it's just, but you see the better graphics, and it's just incredible. You know, like that's such a jaw dropping like fan service way to start the game.
I hadn't seen a game do that before, I don't think, before this.
I don't think I had either. And you still don't see it very much now.
No.
I love that in movies, too.
I do, too.
Like, I love I have three Back to the Future posters in my living room and, like, every version of that thing on a disc.
You know, I mean, I do somewhat professional writing, and I think that a lot of, I don't know if it's the writers or if it's studios, but I mean, somebody's really afraid of like new viewers just feeling like they're left out. And so they have to do the origin story for like every film and video game these days, it seems like. And so,
especially games, man.
Yeah, I know. So it's like we have to establish all the stuff all over again, which I think that's sort of doing a disservice to the player or to the viewer in some cases, in which, you know, they're pretty smart, they'll figure it out.
Even like, Halo 3, like Halo 3 should have picked up the second after Halo 2 ended.
Yes, I completely
agree. Man, like how sick would that have been?
And who wasn't familiar with the franchise at that point and who couldn't just figure it out?
Instead of just dropping from the sky. Yes. It's
anyway, but Symphony of the Night dared to do it is the point, and that's really cool.
Yeah, I think the, just to touch upon the bosses again, that, learning from Igarashi-san, he was saying that the bosses were actually meant for they were rewards for the player, right? Hmm. And there were so many bosses in this game. It's incredible how many they created. Like there were some that I forgot about that I played last week, and I'm like, I had no idea that I was even in the game. Because like both as a gamer and professionally, like bosses are like my thing. That's what I love to play in games. And there's so many in this game. Like it's such a treat for players to be able to like play these epic boss battles. So like this game is just like, it has so many of those.
Yeah. Let's stay on this for a second, because it's not even that they're totally fair. They're not unfair boss battles. And sometimes you're just going to run into a gigantic sphere of like zombie bodies, naked bodies that are constantly being dumped on you. And that was one of those things where, again, I was trying to like figure like, what's the best way to fight this boss? So I go up on a ledge, so I'm a little bit higher. Then I go back down to the ground and there's 80 dudes on the ground, like coming at me. I'm kind of freaking out, but
that's funny, man.
Tons of like great, great boss battles, and all of them feel, you know, different. None of them are unforgiving. You're not getting juggled back and forth. But I'll be real. I did not finish the second castle because it got a lot harder once you get to that second castle. And specifically, I started like wanting to throw my Vita because the like almost maybe 10 minutes into that second castle, there's Medusa heads flying by that turn you into stone. And at the same time, there's dudes throwing swords at you, flying all over the place. And you try to get around it. And then sometimes you get like, I was constantly getting bounced back in, like juggled, pushed into the next room. And then I'd come back and everything was respawned. So all that work I put in was totally erased. And I'm like, oh, I think I played a lot of this game. Maybe I'll go back to it and think of it as a sequel, and maybe I'll play that and save it for a rainy day or something like that.
That's a cool idea, you know, because it almost is like two games.
I'm at 98%. I figured I played a good amount of the
You were credible to talk on a podcast about it. Brian, I have another question for you. Yeah. So you are a game developer, and so anyway, what takeaways do you think game developers who play this game today should have? Like, what do you think they should take away in terms of like the actual craft of building games?
I think it's mostly like the attention to detail. I think there's the main mechanics of the game are done so well like everything feels smooth. Every button has some sort of response. I think it's just a really good example of good controls, pacing. And I think depending on what kind of, you know, field you're in, audio, if your specialty is in level design, I think there's something everyone can take away just by playing the game, because it's so, there's a lot of breadth, there's a breadth to the game and depth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it's a must play for any game developer.
It's a prerequisite. It is, well, you know, you're 101 before you can go into 201.
Yeah, I think so, you know, and Brian sent me and Kevin a tweet the other day with the link to the GDC vault where Igarashi talked about the game and about Metroidvanias in general, and you called it required reading when you sent us that, you know, sort of jokingly. But I kind of, and hearing what you were just talking about in terms of whether people are in audio design or level design, and you were talking about boss design and things like that earlier, you know, I kind of think of this as required reading for developers in general.
I think so, because there's so many layers to this game that every player will have a different experience. So you could look at it as just as a, you know, a playthrough of a game, and then you might not even see 80% of the game, like in Kevin's experience. So I think depending on how deep you want to go, you can get something out of it.
Well, we need to make more young developers play this game then.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. I think the second dungeon is DLC. You know, makes the most sense these days, like our free to play where you can pay $2 to get the better sword and, you know, 50 cents for a regular potion, you know, $1.
Well, we actually saw that Castlevania Harmony of Despair. Wasn't that what it was called? The one on,
that was Xbox Live, right?
Xbox Live Arcade and PSN a few years ago. Yeah. I mean, it had a lot of DLC in it.
Yay, video games. Yep. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. This is where the Castlevania Symphony of the Night section is done. Like, we're just going to do one more segment and talk about current day stuff and maybe some off-topic stuff. So if you want to hang out, if you got a long drive and you feel like hanging out with us for a little bit, stick around. We're going to be right back with that. Final segment. And before we go any further, again, I want to thank you out there for listening. If you've joined us in this last year and you've been checking out the podcast and supporting us, and if you're new and recent to the show, you can always go back. All these episodes are available for free on iTunes, so you can check them out.
It's the 1 year anniversary of Back in My Play, right?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I feel kind of fortunate that this episode landed on that, you know, on the date. It's kind of cool.
Mm.
I really like this show because it feels like, you know, I'm talking, you know, listening to my friends talk about video games, and there's something really to be said about celebrating video games and the fun that people have socializing behind it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think there should be more of that in our industry. So I think it's really good that you guys are doing that. And that's why I like this show so much.
Oh, thanks, man. Appreciate it. That's our goal. If you want to think about our mission statement when it comes to doing this stuff, it is, you know, talking about the stuff that we love from the past. And, you know, if you do have an iTunes account and you listen to other, you know, video game podcasts and stuff like that, I think Josh is going into his house.
I'm back, by the way. That was, my internet just died all of a sudden. I don't know what happened.
Okay, you're good.
So I missed Brian saying what sounded like kind words. So
I can vouch for it.
Okay.
And, you know, with a lot of stuff going on out there today, lots of negativity. People aren't, you know, enjoying the way, you know, things are happening sometimes, I guess. But I play video games and Josh plays video games and Brian plays video games because they're fun. Like, they're supposed to be fun. And if you're not having fun playing video games, go like open up a book or watch a movie or something like that. You know, desaturate yourself a little bit so you don't have to get sick of this stuff. You should never get sick of music or movies or any kind of entertainment and stuff like that. And with this stuff, it's like we only play games that we want to play. And even with stuff that was forced on me, Mylon's Secret Castle, that's why Jonathan Metz did not get a thank you at the beginning. So maybe play that. He made me spend money on that game and then play it. like I don't know what is going on. Like Nintendo World Report, I would always, you know, take a second look at that stuff before you, you know, take it. I'm just kidding. Anyways, hopefully, you know, people out there that are listening to the show, they're enjoying it. And, like you said, this is just, you know, friends talking about old games that they like playing and also looking back on them. So that's great to hear.
Yeah. I think it's good once in a while to just kind of take a step back and just remember why you love video games. Mm. And even doing that, it's like, it's so much fun to just talk about it with friends. Like, there's playing video games and the other side of it is just kind of like celebrating it with friends. Cause that's, that's fun on its own. Right.
Yeah. And I've been dying right now to talk to someone about The Walking Dead because I've been playing that the last couple of days. Like, I'm like, who can I talk to about this? Like, I need to share this with someone. And it's, and it's like getting that new game and saying, oh man, have you been playing this? Like when BioShock Infinite came out, you know, I need to talk to somebody about the ending of that game. It's that kind of stuff that makes this show fun. And I am a guy that is, like, for lack of a better term, just very nostalgic. Like, I like looking back on my past and history and stuff like that, especially with these old games that meant a lot to me growing up in my childhood and stuff.
So, Walking Dead, then, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
All I'm going to say, because, you know, I know there's still some people out there that haven't played it. I'm not going to spoil anything. I just want to say that I was one of those people out there that, was, you know, man, people just talk so highly about this game. It can really not be that good. It just must be, you know, these people saying, like, yeah, you know, I like the emotional experience in my video games. You know, I can play Contra. Like, I don't need an emotional experience. But I've been playing this on the PlayStation Vita again for the last 3 days. I've played an episode a night, like from 8 to like 9:15, I'll play an episode. And it's like watching a TV show. It's like watching two episodes of a show. So the game itself is, it's like, it's kind of not a game. It is in the sense where there are some action moments, but it's a lot of decision making and a lot of exploring, like adventure games, which, like, I mentioned a second ago, I absolutely love Back to the Future. Those are my three favorite movies of all time, with, you know, the Fast and Furious movies right behind it. The Back to the Future game was made for me. I cannot play that game because it's just like, I don't want to go searching around for stuff. Maybe someday, maybe if they port it to the Vita, like I'll play it. Like, it's just like playing these games on a portable device seems to be a little bit more appealing to me. But the choices that you make, the third episode, like, I don't tear up like at movies and stuff like that. I was crying in the third episode. It's that good in terms of the writing and the storytelling and the voice acting. And I understand why. I was talking to these guys off the air. This got Game of the Year at the Jeff Keighley Awards last year, 2 years ago, and it was well-deserved.
Can we just always call it that?
It is the Jeff Keighley Awards.
Yeah.
It's not the BGX.
Yeah. I think it should be called the Joel McHale Awards.
The Awkward Pause Awards or something.
Yeah, well, Joel McHale is somebody who's near and dear to my heart, so honestly, I do like the guy a lot.
Yeah, his show just got canceled.
Yeah, that's the kind of life I lead, where like the things I do don't work out. So I respect that.
So I'm
is that depressing enough?
Yeah, it's for sure. But I've okay. never, I'm not good at sitting down and playing games like straight through. I always take breaks. Like, that's again why I'm playing a lot of stuff on, you know, my 2DS and Vita, is because I like to be able to go into sleep mode, walk around, go do something else, jump back on the computer, do some work, then go play a little bit later. And that's this game is just, it needs to be played just in terms of a storytelling. Like, I just, that's what I want to do right now. I want to hang up on you guys and go play more of that game, which hasn't happened in a long time.
I'm really excited to go play it. I mean, like, after hearing all of this, I just didn't really understand what it was. And I'm not a fan.
It's still free. Just,
is it really?
Yeah.
On PSN?
On everything. Yeah.
I just was never a fan of I liked the comic okay, and I'd never liked the television show.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I tried to watch it. Yeah, and so it was the IP, honestly, though, that was keeping me away from it. But knowing that this is not heavily connected to the IP now, that changes some things for me.
Dude, I can only imagine how you're going to feel as a father with a daughter playing that game.
Yeah.
It's going to be even more emotional for you, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'll get ready for some tears. You know, I've reached that point in my life where I certainly cry about these kinds of things. Earlier, when we were talking, Brian, you kind of had an interesting story about playing Walking Dead, like, not alone.
Oh, yeah. Like, my wife was playing, like, I was playing the game, and she actually enjoyed just watching the game and helping out with the choices that you make, because throughout the game, you make choices that branches the story and mm-hmm. all that stuff. So it was almost like a TV show for her that she can interact with. So I was playing, she was helping make decisions, and then you're like anticipating the next episode, which was really fun.
Did you play it all at once, or were you playing it like an episode at a time, then you had to wait 3 weeks to get the next one?
I was playing it like I was watching it like you're on TV. So I had to wait, you know, whatever it was, 3 weeks for each episode. That was pretty tough. Like, just because the game was so good, right? So yeah. You don't get that anticipation in many games nowadays, right? Like, you get the anticipation leading up and then the game's released. But now with this, it's like you get to play a little bit and you wait a month and you get to play more. So like that, like, build up to the excitement is pretty fun too.
Have you played Wolf Among Us?
Are you talking to Brian?
You guys can just field whichever question, either Kevin's question or my question.
I have not played that, but I think that if this goes well, I think that is going to have to be on my list because...
What was it?
The Wolf Among Us.
Wolf Among Us.
Oh, not yet. I heard it's really good.
Yeah, that's an interesting IP. You know, isn't that from the Fables universe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which, you know, my wife has some experience with those books. So yeah. I should probably give that a try. That might be a good, like... Hey, this is something that we can do as a married couple, you know, based on the story that you were telling just a minute ago, Brian.
Yeah. Like, I don't know much about that universe. So, like, as someone who doesn't know the story or anything, is it still as exciting or for new people? Or
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, it has more, like, you know, supernatural types of elements to it, you know? I mean, okay. Well, it's like in a gritty world or whatever, but, you know, and the whole idea is that you have some of these characters from, like, famous fables of history.
Okay.
It's you like know, like the League in of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but for those folks.
Yeah, exactly. And I probably did a bad job of explaining that. And, you know, feel free to tell me that on Twitter and about what it really is. But I've seen the books lying around in my house.
Cool. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. It's supposed to be really good, though, by all accounts. Yeah. The Player One podcast guys seem to like it, except for Mike.
Oh, that's okay.
That was just a shout out to him in a roundabout way.
Speaking of the portable gods, we are being graced with new hardware this week. The Nintendo has a new 2DS color coming out, a white and red model with new Super Mario Brothers 2 packed in.
I didn't know about this.
Oh, what dude, it looks pretty good. It's white as the main color and red around the edges.
Was this announced today or something?
I saw it on NeoGAF, so I don't know.
Okay. And I'm a big proponent of the 2DS. I just love it. I think the D-pad feels really great on it. So, you know, if you don't have one, this would be a good time to get one.
More colors. I like having more options. Love the more colors. And same thing on the other spectrum, PlayStation Vita, a new black and red and black and blue. Which both look pretty sick, which means, man, I just keep buying portable consoles. And I've that backlit Game Boy Advance now, which is friggin' awesome. Oh my God, that thing is awesome. Yeah. So I think that, might be, about it. I don't know. Brian, is there anything else that you've been playing? Is there anything that's on your plate?
Like I've been playing the, you know, the games everyone else has been playing, like Mario Kart 8 and Mario Golf.
What do you think of Mario Kart 8? We had you were part of our game night last week. Thank you to everyone that jumped on to play some Mario Kart 8. Awesome. I'm sorry for dropping an F-bomb on the chat. I was getting a little frustrated. I don't know if I held it back, but I thought I was like, man, this is effing. Oh no, I was like, because in the chat room, like you can talk through your microphone or there's these pre-made like text things like I'm using tilt controls or I'm scared or something like that. And I'm like, where's the FU button? Because you hit me like with a shell, like right as I was in first place at the last lap or something like that. So that was a ton of fun. But what are your thoughts on that?
Mario Kart 8, it's actually really fun. Like it feels like Mario Kart. It's totally like the tracks. I love the track design, like the verticality that they have. And the one thing I did notice was it's the first game where my wife and her friends asked me to play it. They all wanted to play it. They all played local player on the weekend. And it was a ton of fun. And playing online with friends, like up to 12 people with a silky smooth frame rate. Like that's really fun.
Yeah, it worked. I mean, I had no lag playing it online, and it worked. Like it was a ton of fun. It's I think the best looking game on the Wii U. It looks fantastic.
Yeah,
I'm going to make an outrageous claim and say that I think it's the best looking game of this generation so far. Like I'd rather look at this than Killzone Shadowfall.
You've been listening to 8-4 play or something?
Is that what they've been talking about?
JJ was like, I think it looks way better than anything on the PlayStation 4. Like, JJ, have you played Second Son? No.
played it though. I have. I mean, it's just like, it's a difference. It's like apples and oranges, you know? I mean, like, yes, in terms of like,
it's aesthetically, it's more aesthetically pleasing, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And it's just so bright and colorful and
beautiful. That's Nintendo, man. Like that's hit it out of the park every single time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Super Mario 3D World was one of my favorite games to look at last year, just because everything is like the technology is there now where everything is smooth. Like everything looks like it's, you know, couldn't look better. You know what I mean? Like it looks like it doesn't need to look any better.
Yeah. I think with technology now, like we're reaching like such a point where like everything, you know, really good graphics are really cheap, like in terms of hardware. Mm-hmm. So I think previous generations were pushing for realism, whereas now we can push for stylistic really cool looking things. And I think that's where all the interesting stuff will come from in the next generation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm, you know, cause like Sunset Overdrive looks really cool, like in terms of an aesthetic.
Yeah. One game I actually wanted to talk about that I've been playing is Rusty's Real Deal Baseball.
Nice.
I don't know if you guys have played this game, but
this is a Chris Johnston minute for to talk about Rusty's Real Deal Baseball as we continue to partner with Player One Podcast.
I just love that it's this new approach to solving the free-to-play issue where it's like you don't feel like you have to purchase things, but I feel like there's motivation to do it. It's not like this is the first time I've ever bought something in a free-to-play game.
Well, and talk about that, you know, like sort of Walking Dead feeling of like, what's going to happen next with this crazy story?
Oh, wait, there's a story?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, there's a story.
I haven't downloaded this game, so.
You got to try it.
He's slowly, like, sinking into madness a little bit, you know, like he's lost everything that mattered to him. And
wait, it's not a baseball game?
It is to some extent. Like the mini games are.
I thought it was just like a home run derby or something like that.
No, but, man. Like, yeah, go for it, Brian.
Oh, pretty much what it is you're a character in this world, and there's this guy, ex baseball player who runs his own sporting goods store, and he noticed that kids aren't buying baseball equipment, so now he's going to start selling baseball mini cartridges for the Nintendo 4DS to try and get kids interested in baseball so that they'll buy, you know, equipment at his store. And throughout this process, you're learning more about Rusty, and he has 10 kids, and during your transactions with him, you learn new information about him, and you earn items when you play the mini games, and they make you feel sorry for him. So you don't want to haggle him as much, right? So, because the idea is you haggle them to get the lowest possible price, but you end up kind of feeling bad for getting that low price.
Yeah, it's like, well, can his kids still eat tonight?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, like, that's like legitimately a question you'll ask yourself, not like, I'm not joking around. Like, that's
pretty serious.
Like, there's some pretty heavy themes in this game that I've never seen before, like in a video game like this.
You guys,
like,
are being serious, you're not just kidding? Because I almost tune it out every time I hear it. Like,
I'm
people
serious.
Bring this up on a podcast.
Yeah,
I'm serious. The actual gameplay is in those cartridges. You purchase those cartridges from him, and it'll be like a batting cage cartridge, or like you're the umpire making calls cartridge. And those little mini games are really fun. Like, the actual batting mechanics feel really, really good. And when I play that game, I feel like, oh, I wish there was more Japanese made 2D, like NES style baseball games like they used to make, right? Because they don't really make those anymore.
All right.
Are you turning it on? Is that what I hear? Yeah, at least just play. Because, I mean, you can like have that initial interaction with Rusty for free, like without, you know, without buying any of the mini games yet.
All right, I'm going on the eShop. Don't worry about it. I got it. Yeah. All right.
We should, Brian, it would have been funny though if we like made up a game and pitched it to Kevin and we're like, you gotta play it, you know, like it has all this crazy stuff in it.
Yeah, that, I mean, it just totally was never on my radar.
Yeah,
I guess.
Play it.
Even this is while listening to like the 8 video game podcasts that I listen to. So that's, yeah, I promise to check it out and give it a look. It's interesting.
Well, I'm glad that we influence at least one more person to play it. So
I have like $6 left in my eShop account.
Okay.
So just
you can get a couple mini games.
Yeah.
Oh, this is also a public service announcement to use your Club Nintendo points before June 30th. Like, I have 1,000 points in there I get to spend before those things run out.
Wait, what's going to happen?
You have to use up the rest of your Club Nintendo points before June 30th. That's when the new year starts.
Oh yeah, but I think your points still carry over, don't they?
No, it says make sure you use your points.
I think it depends on when you registered them.
Okay.
I think it might be like the points that Kevin has expires on June 30th.
I have special points.
Yeah. Well, I think they're time.
They make Kevin Spentes.
I think they just expire after a certain period of time.
That might be that sounds right.
Yeah, that scared me for a minute.
Yeah.
I like the idea of Kevin having special points though.
Yeah,
we're going to need you to go ahead and download Urban Champion.
Coins. No, it's coins. Well, there should be some new games coming up next week. So
Yeah, that's I actually look forward to that every month. I'm like,
totally.
Yeah. Because I feel like I spend more coins now than out. They have all those digital rewards.
Yeah. This month in the US they have Kirby's Adventure, that's a game I really want to do on the show. Super Metroid and Mario Kart 64, like 3 for 3.
Not bad.
Those are, yeah, great games. Let's see. And also, I think that is that might be where we wrap it up, because we have E3 coming next week, and it's kind of like where all the crazy stuff to talk about is going to happen. So I think we will wrap it up. I will say there are some still cool things in the works for Back in My Play, including some new t-shirts that are going to be sporting the Japanese consoles for the Famicom, the PC Engine, and the Super Famicom. So those will be coming soon. Lloyd is working hard at his real job. So once he has some time and things quiet down, he'll be jumping on those, and I will get those on the internet as fast as humanly possible. But
I believe Lloyd is a professional Sonic fan fiction writer.
Maybe
that's his job. He's working hard on it.
Maybe. And also, I'm going to be doing another interview with Blake Harris from Console Wars. Going to be doing a follow up with him. And also, I postponed an interview I was going to do with Mike Mica this week about his E3 memories, and talking a little bit more about collecting video games and doing some more stuff on programming. Like, it is. I've pitched it to him, and he seems to be okay with doing like a monthly Mike Mica talk. I'm just going to call him up on Skype and figure out what we're going to talk to him about. Just because it is like going to, the store and talking to the guy that has all these stories and things like that. So that will be great. And I'm sure we're going to be doing more games down the road, some more Sega stuff's going to be coming up, and I don't know. We got a whole nother year ahead of us as long as, nothing crazy happens. But, before we wrap up, again, thank you so much to Brian for coming on. You can check him out at GameplayDev on, Twitter. Yeah. Brian, thank you so much, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
We'll get you on again. Maybe we'll talk about Castlevania 64, I have the Japanese version of that. I don't know how easy that's going to be able to play. And also, you can follow myself at Kevin Larrabee, and Josh is at Joshua Hillier. And don't forget, at Back in My Play, we broke 200 followers on the Back in My Play Twitter. So that is great. And since I do have all these coins, I think I'm just going to give out some codes on the Twitter account, because I own Super Metroid. I own Mario Kart 64. And I would like to buy a copy of Kirby's Adventure to have a US version. I also have a pink Famicom version, but I'd like to.
How cool is that?
It is cool, man. You got to get out to Japan and just go and drop like $3,000 on games.
I really, truly want to.
I got my
more
next
than anything.
One. I got my ballpark set up for October to head back out there to buy some more stuff. And that's going to be the Sega Saturn trip. So after that, we can do Sega Saturn stuff, but
yes.
That's going to do it for us. Don't forget to check out the show on iTunes. You can also, go to backinmyplay.com where, there might actually be stuff besides the podcast on there. I will do part two of that series of the, best or Back in My Play retro approved products, where you can check out the stuff out there that is made specifically for us that are into retro games, and not just the garbage that people are trying to cash in on. And so far, reviews of the Retron 5, I don't know. I think I might have been justified in my warnings to people out there. Hopefully they can get those working a little bit better. And I got Greg Seward to buy a XRGB mini Framemeister. So my job is done. We can call it a podcast.
Wow, I didn't realize he bought one.
He dropped like $400 on one of those and some cables for his Genesis.
Sheesh.
So
that man loves Sega.
Yeah. Brian, you gotta get one of those. You know that, right?
Yeah, that's what I hear. But that's why I think I love portables nowadays, like Vita and 3DS. Like, those games are being displayed without any interference, right? So like in a way I'm kind of getting the RGB.
Yeah, but you can have those fat plastic carts with boards in them stuff, and then you can blow in the cartridge and stuff like that and hook it up to a 55-inch TV and just see big fat pixels. It is it's quite an experience, especially with like PC Engine. Like, hook that thing up through a SCART cable. Wow, that stuff is. If you're listening, I think we almost had an effect because people weren't able to get Framemeisters for the last like month and a half because they've been sold out everywhere. I would like to take credit for that. So that's going to do it for us again. You know where to catch us, and I don't know
what. Buy my book.
Yeah, buy the book.
Well, Train of Thought, Amazon, which I don't like Amazon right now, but it's okay. Buy it anyway.
What's wrong with Amazon?
I don't like what they're doing to publishers and some authors here and there in terms of.
Yeah, they're mad at the Stephen Colbert. I saw that.
Yeah, there's a lot of people they're angry with right now. And, you know, so like I'm associated with them because I have an exclusivity agreement with them, you know, for this book. And I'm working on getting it onto a few other services, though. But in the meantime, it's only available there.
Oh, and also if you email or follow us on Twitter at @backofmyplay, and then send me a tweet. If you live in the United States, the first 15 people that do that, I'll send you a couple free Back of My Play stickers.
Nice.
15 people, do it. So do it, first 15 people to hear this. And also make sure you're also following myself and Josh and Brian. And
okay,
and I think at Player One.
Whoa. Player One podcast.
Thanks, everyone, and have a great week. We love you.